You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 12, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, chair of the Centennial Red and Roses Strike Celebration, Bob Ferrant. He's a professor at UMass Lowell in Massachusetts. He'll tell us about the Red and Roses Strike that took place in 1912. Because of the politics of envy that had permeated that country, just that one brief moment, and then apparently just the other day. Also on the program today, Rick Perry gets into the CNN debate with just a little bit of fudgy. No problem, should make it fun. Occupy Wall Street. The resonance continues. A new poll out by Pew, which shows that class conflict is the biggest conflict that Americans across the board perceive today. Also, Andrew Breitbart mentee James O'Keefe trying to prove that there's such a thing as voter fraud, commits voter fraud, but doesn't even actually cast a ballot. We'll get to that food stamps story that I had talked about yesterday, didn't get to. Also, I want to say thank you to listener Kim, who has turned the Dollar Lunch District, temporarily, into something far greater. Sent us a couple of gift certificates, essentially, little gift cards to Schnippers, which is right around the corner from us. So we'll be enjoying some of that quality kitchen fare. And I bring up this issue of food, ladies and gentlemen, and you'll see why as I tell you this story. This is, of course, rather disturbing. As reported by Think Progress, the 10th Circuit of Appeals struck down Oklahoma's ban on Sharia law 2 days ago, declaring that the Sooner State move violated the United States Constitution. In November of 2010, Oklahoma voters approved a ballot initiative to prevent creeping Sharia law from being used in the state, something that even the measure's defenders could not identify as ever happening. As the court said, or wrote, appellants do not identify any actual problem the challenged amendment seeks to solve. Now, I think the court was being a little bit obtuse here. Obviously, the problem is a combination of creeping Sharia, one part creeping Sharia, and nine parts the Republican Party doesn't have a viable boogeyman to run against, because the population has become far less homophobic because a lot of those old homophobes have, frankly, died. And so they can't trot out. The gays are coming to get you. So there is an actual problem, and that is that the Republican Party and conservatives everywhere don't have a ready fix for their jonesing for something that's coming to get them. But, you know, courts are, you know how the courts are. Indeed, they admitted at the preliminary injunction that they did not know of even a single instance where an Oklahoma court had applied Sharia law or used the legal precepts of other nations or cultures, let alone that such application or uses had resulted in concrete problems in Oklahoma. So there's two tests there. One, you need to show that it's actually been used, and then you also have to show that it's problematic. Now, I think the court, like I say, is being a little narrow here. This court ruling happened only 2 days ago. And just yesterday, I decided that I was going to mix it up a little bit, not go for a dollar burger or a dollar pizza. And so I went to that place across the street that is right next door to that coffee shop. And they were serving all sorts of food that was halal. In other words, okay for Muslims to eat.
Isn't halal kosher?
You're saying it's a kosher restaurant?
That's what I believe.
Okay, well, so kosher as in like Jews can eat that food if they follow the laws of kashrut.
That's usually what kosher means.
Well, look. What's really the difference? Semitic. Semitic laws are coming to force us to eat things like no cheese with our meat. I don't know if that's halal necessarily, but I think we get the point. Sharia is creeping all around us. And where are the guys from the Wolverines in Red Dawn? Where are they to stop us? These activist courts stopping the creeping halal and kosher laws. That's what. Oh, let's take a break. I need to gain some composure. When we come back, we'll be talking to Bob Front on the 100th anniversary of Bread and Roses strike in Lowell, Massachusetts. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, professor and senior research fellow from UMass Lowell and the chair of the Centennial Committee of the Bread and Roses Strike, Bob Ferrant. And going into the break, I said that the strike happened in Lowell. It actually happened in Lawrence.
Laurentians would never forgive you.
Well, as a Worcester native, you know.
Oh, okay.
Lawrence
you
and Lowell.
You get them confused.
Same place. Yeah. You know.
I get Worcester confused with Gloucester, so it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's just for Worcesterites, it's just a competition as to which is the more depressing city sometimes.
Uh-huh.
But what are you going to do? So this is the 100 year anniversary. Tell us about what the working conditions were like back in 1912. That set the table for this strike?
Lawrence was primarily a woolen mill city. At the time, there were mills. Lawrence was probably one of the most densely populated places in the country. The city was 7 square miles. It was basically mills and worker housing and not a whole lot else. Lawrence had was among the top five cities in the country, top five being top worst, in infant mortality, in deaths of children under five, in regular mortality. The typical mill worker, if they started work when they were 15 or 16, a lot of them wouldn't have made it past age 25. So extraordinarily difficult working conditions, and as well, workers were making very little in terms of wages, which forced lots of families into the not a great choice of, in some cases, falsifying how old the kids were to get them into the mills. In Massachusetts, you could work in the mills if you were 14, but some people actually falsified birth certificates to get their kids to work at 13 because they just simply didn't have enough money to buy food, buy medicine, and pay rent.
Where were these immigrants from at the time?
Essentially, Lawrence is sort of the global city. There's people from Lithuania, Poland, Russia, Italy, France, Belgium, Quebec. There are 50 different nationalities in the city and equally as many languages at the time of the strike.
And so so how did the strike start? I mean, what was the predicate, and where did it come from? A specific the textile industry.
Well, the woolen industry, I mean, it's hard for us to think about this now since so much of that kind of work has gone abroad, but at the time in the early 1900s, the woolen industry in the U.S. was a very powerful industry, like steel or, you know, rubber or coal or the sugar monopoly or whatever. And so there was a woolen trust, and William Wood was the owner of about 30 woolen mills in New England, several of them in Lawrence. In 1911, the Massachusetts legislature passed a law to reduce the legal work week for women and children from 56 hours to 54 a week. Doesn't sound like much of a reform now, but from 56 to 54 hours. This had happened a few years previously, going from 58 to 56, and during that time, employers did not cut the wages of their workers, but as the new year approached, as January 1 approached in 1912, workers were asking the mill owners what was going to happen, were the wages going to be cut, were they going to stay the same, what have you. And the mill owners refused to meet with delegations of workers. There had already been some union organizing going on in Lawrence. The Industrial Workers of the World, in particular, was in Lawrence organizing immigrants. Small immigrant unions of Italian workers, Franco-Belgian workers, Jewish workers. And so there was a lot of meetings taking place from January 1 through January 9, 10. The mill owners still didn't clarify what they were going to do. On January 11, the first payday of the new year for some workers, about 400 workers got their pay, saw they were short. They work in the Everett Mill, which is actually the mill I'm standing in right now, which is really cool. So anyway, they got their pay. They realized their pay was cut, and they walked off the job, and they started marching through the city, going to other mills, yelling, short pay, all out. The next day, January 12, more workers showed up for work, got their pay. Their pay was cut too. That was on a Friday, so at that point, the strike was on.
Now, they weren't getting paid by the hour at that time, were they?
Some were getting paid hourly. Some were getting paid by the piece. And so it was a mixed bag. If you were more skilled, you might be getting paid, by the hour. Less skilled workers, which tended to be the newer immigrants, were generally paid by the piece. In the past, what had happened when it went, say, from the 58 to the 56, the mill owners simply sped up the machines and got the same amount of, wool production off the machinery as they did, in 56 hours. And so they just pay people the same. They just sped up the machinery and work people harder. For whatever reason, in this case, they refused. They didn't do this, nor would they meet with the workers. And so workers were, again, upset by the fact that they wanted to get some straight answers, and the mill owners just simply refused to meet with them. My guess is, although I've never found, like, real hard evidence, my guess is all the mill owners at some point in December of 1911, had a meeting somewhere, probably in a smoke-filled room, and decided they were all going to agree to cut everybody's wages so that it wouldn't be like a few mills cutting and a few mills not. And then they just decided to produce this united front come the new year and not deal with their workers at all. And that's my suspicion, at least, because all the mills in unison did the same thing.
Now, let me get you. I want to just stop here for a moment and ask you, you know, I've been told by libertarians who have argued this point to me that things like child labor laws and presumably cutting down the work week in this instance was simply a function of would have happened anyways, that because of technological gains, because of productivity gains, this is something that the mill owners would have done on their own. Because just the market would have made it possible for them to do it. Do you have any sense that would have happened on their own?
Without having a crystal ball, maybe you could say that at some point, 20, 30 years into the future or something like that, maybe such a thing would have happened. But, I mean, on the ground in the moment, when you're deciding to falsify your kid's birth certificate, and put them to work in a mill building, and you know the work isn't safe, and you know it's going to really impinge on your child's economic future, and that's the choice that you're forced to make. The idea that a libertarian or anybody else might have, I think that, well, eventually it's going to get better, eventually doesn't put food on the table. And so, I mean, that was really the crux of the issue. Workers were, as many people are today, forced to choose between buying medicine for your kid or making a mortgage payment or a car payment or what have you. I mean, it's a much harsher climate back in 1912, but right. Workers are put in that same, so, you know, it's like, it's a no-win choice.
What was the,
so they can't wait.
Why did the state reduce the, time spent working?
The state was doing it because it was part of the, in America, the so-called progressive era, and these things were happening everywhere. Wisconsin, Massachusetts, other states were passing reforms after the March of 1911 Triangle Fire. Changes were made in New York state law. There was an industrial commission that was set up to look at questions of safety. So the strike really was part of a whole sort of move in the country as people became more aware of what conditions were like in this, you know, so-called second industrial revolution in America with the growth of these big companies. As people became more aware, at least some people in government began to introduce and suggest a variety of reforms. The strike is really crucial in that sense because it really becomes a national story. When you look at newspapers from all over the country came in the early days of the strike to cover it. And then as the strike lasted for about 60 days, right around the middle of it, reporters started coming from newspapers from all over Europe, since there are so many immigrants from those countries. And so there are lots of foreign language reporters who are in town writing about the strike too. So it puts this question of, you know, industry and big industry and what are the conditions in big industry before people. And it's sort of, you know, it forces politicians to decide what are they, you know, whose side are they on.
Why do they call it, why was it called the Bread and Roses Strike?
It's actually, when it's happening, it's called the Great Lawrence Textile Strike. Bread and Roses doesn't really appear while the strike is going on. It's sort of grafted onto it afterwards. James Oppenheim writes a poem in 1911 called Bread and Roses, which eventually gets turned into the song that a lot of people are familiar with these days that a variety of different folk singers have put to music. But after the fact, when people a few years later begin to look at the issues in the strike, the notion of bread, obviously food, we need food on the table, and roses, it's really a metaphor for, you know, having a better quality of life, a decent life, better prospects and opportunities for your kids. So it's not just work. It's sort of trying to think about working people for the first time really as actually whole people. And so Bread and Roses has really sort of got grafted onto it, and it's really the way the strike is remembered. So I think it's a really, you know, it's a really good metaphor for what was going on at the time.
And, you know, I read a piece in the Globe. My sense is that the short wages was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, and there was just horrible working conditions there as well.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the working conditions were really harsh. I mean, again, large numbers of workers died from a variety of lung ailments. I mean, people didn't necessarily then associate, you know, occupational medicine the way we think about it today. But so many workers, when you look at cause of death, it's something related to a lung ailment from breathing in, you know, fibers and dust and everything at work. Lots of workers are actually badly hurt on the job and died just like 2 days before the strike actually takes place. A young boy's caught in an elevator, loses his leg and dies from, you know, from excessive bleeding. Not a great thing to be talking about, I guess, at lunchtime, but reality is reality. And right. So all of it taken together. So, right. I mean, if it was just the wage cut in the moment without all of this other sort of organizing going on, without the sort of rising discontent, the strike probably would have happened, but in a few days it would have, it probably would have petered out. The fact that people were able to hang together over such a long period of time is testimony to the fact that people, because they're so crowded together in Lawrence, people are living together. I mean, there are somewhat distinct immigrant neighborhoods in the city, but a lot of people live in really mixed neighborhoods where you'll see Italians living next to Poles, living next to, you know, people from Quebec and whatever. And so, I mean, a lot of this is really the strength of the women in the strike. Women sort of are really struggling, you know, day to day to try to make ends meet, keep the household together, work, raise kids, you know, do the double shift that everybody talks about today. They're doing it back then. And the women really have each other's back before the strike starts. And so, again, once the strike starts, there's a level of trust and such. The other thing that happens different from a lot of strikes at this point in U.S. history is when the industrial workers of the world come in, they insist that the strike committee be comprised of representatives from all the different immigrant groups, language groups in the city. All the strike material is translated into multiple languages. And so there's really this real focus on building unity across the city. And that's very powerful. The mill owners don't expect it. And it's why they think that on Monday, everybody walks out on Friday. They think on Monday people are going to be back to work. And what they find is 10,000 people in a moving picket line parading down through the downtown streets.
To the extent that the Shirtwaist Triangle fire and subsequent strikes and marches and reforms that took place then, to the extent that influenced this strike, are there other strikes that you can point to that took place around the country in the wake of this one that took their inspiration from this one?
Yeah, I mean, there's one pretty soon after this one in 1913 in Paterson, New Jersey, another really large textile strike. It doesn't have as successful an outcome. I mean, what happens fairly soon after this strike, I mean, the issues are raised, the issues are on the agenda. There's organizing going on. World War One happens. World War One sort of gets in the way of the organizing activity. Right after World War One, we have the Palmer Raids and a period of time in U.S. history that we call the Red Scare. It's when, if anybody saw the J. Edgar Hoover movie, they'll see him in action. And in Lawrence, lots of the strike leaders are actually involved in a strike in Lawrence in 1919. They're rounded up in these FBI raids, and they're actually put on ships and deported. And so a lot of the gains that are made by workers, in not just in Lawrence, but in other parts of the country just prior to World War One, sort of go by the boards in this sort of Red Scare, swing to the right that takes place after World War One. In the 1920s, are very much given over again to big business and wealth and deregulation and all the rest of it. And so you really don't see, at least again, the way I think about U.S. labor history, you really don't see permanent, anything you could think of as permanent happening until 1935 when you get the National Labor Relations Act. And then in 1937, when you get the Fair Labor Standards Act, you get minimum wages, you get much more aggressive child labor laws and things like that.
You said in the Globe that Lawrence was really the first Occupy movement. I think most of my audience will, has a sense of why that might be the case, but elaborate on that.
Well, I mean, I didn't really think about it until I started doing more getting ready for everything that we've been working on for the past several months. And what I think when I think of the contemporary Occupy movement, I think of it as putting the the issues of income inequality and too much big business control over politics and such on the front page of the newspaper and placing it inside the political dialogue that the country is having in an election year. 1912 is an election year as well back then, and the strike really puts on the front page of the newspapers the dramatic wage inequality in America in 1912, the really the hazardous work, the exploitation of young children, and all of that. And so that you can choose to look away if you want to, but you can't choose to claim ignorance. And I think that's the same thing that's happened with Occupy. You can choose to pretend there isn't this income inequality and joblessness and all the other things that people have talked about with Occupy, but you're just choosing to not look at reality. And I think the same thing happened back then. The strike put reality in front of everybody when they got up in the morning and looked at their Boston Globe or New York Times or whatever other paper they read back then.
Did you have people like our former government governor from Massachusetts talking about the idea of this just all being about the politics of envy, or were they?
I don't see that term in there. But I mean, what you do find that's really fascinating is when the strike begins, the mayor of Lawrence calls on the governor of Massachusetts to send in the state militia to protect private property. The state militia shows up fairly quickly. One contingent of the state militia are Harvard students. So you get another really interesting sort of class distinction there where it's Harvard students. And what's really clear when you look at the history is the wealth that was generated in Lawrence by the really wealthy families who were the investors. They turn around and give tons and tons of that money to Harvard. Half of the buildings at Harvard were built back then with money given as donations from mill owners in places like Lowell and Lawrence and Fall River and New Bedford. And at the same time as the Harvard boys are up here in the militia, the daughters who are going to, Bryn Mawr and Radcliffe and Sarah Lawrence and Smith and Mount Holyoke are actually hosting strikers coming and talking about the strike and coming up with donations to support the strike. So another really interesting sort of, I guess that's class warfare. That's family class warfare of a sort.
That's it's fascinating to me because there seems at least historically to be, and maybe this is just because we're talking about this strike and we're talking about the shirt waist. And, but it seems that the presence of women, at least in the labor movement, at least during that time, was sort of a key element. I mean, the organizing amongst women for some. Am I making too much of that, or was that?
No. But I think that what's important to point out is that the establishment trade unions of the time, the American Federation of Labor unions at the time, were not organizing those women. Those women were actually more self-organizing and organizing in newer independent unions. The AFL really was not so interested in general. I mean, there are exceptions to the rule, but in general, the American Federation of Labor was not interested in organizing unskilled workers, women workers, immigrant workers. And so, it's the industrial workers of the world who are, the one big union, as one of their, one of their slogans. That's really one of the major actors in Lawrence. And so a lot of the key organizers are people that are members of the IWW in Lawrence. And then when the strike begins, people like Big Bill Hayward and Elizabeth Flynn, Arturo Giovannitti, Joe Ettore, these are famous names in industrial workers of the world history. They're all in Lawrence. And they're the people that are really pushing for organizing women, for creating these multi-ethnic strike committee, translating everything into all these languages. Not something that the AFL necessarily would have done.
All right. Lastly, let me ask you this. I mean, the value of marking these centennials, the value of remembering these strikes. There's a political value to this. I mean, and we could see this sort of, I guess, the opposite when we see guys like Governor LaPage up in Maine, wanting to take down a mural.
Those murals are actually going to be here in the Centennial exhibit in the spring, so that'll be kind of fun.
Oh, fantastic. All right, well,
we're going to invite him to come down, but I don't think he will.
Maybe we can get a fund up to send him a car.
Yeah.
But tell me about...
I drive it, actually.
I mean, obviously, you're chairing the Centennial Committee. What's the value of this to current day society? I mean, it's not just simply to maintain a historical record, is it?
No, I mean, we just did this the event this morning to open the exhibit. There were about 350 Lawrence Middle School and High School students here. To hear the story and participate, we did a strike reenactment. We marched from the Everett Mill to City Hall. And so I think it's a way to talk about how people can empower themselves. It's a way to talk to people about the fact that back then, even though people were in that desperate situation, that they actually had agency, that they could do something to affect their situations. They didn't just have to take it. So for me, at least, I mean, I teach history at a university, and so this is far afield from what a lot of my colleagues necessarily would do. But I just think, how do you not sort of take the history and figure out a way to make it relevant to the particularities of today? So we think this has huge, huge impact in terms of, particularly in Lawrence. Lawrence is still an immigrant city. It's still a poor city. It's still a mill city. And sort of having that conversation, where do we want Lawrence to be 50 years from now? I think it really matters.
Bob Ferrant from UMass Lowell, thank you so much for taking the time to tell us about that strike.
My pleasure. If people want to find out more, find out about the exhibit, come up and take a visit. Anybody in the listening audience, breadandrosescentennial.org, all one word, Bread and Roses Centennial. You'll find the website, a virtual exhibit, and all sorts of other stuff.
We'll put a link on our blog at majority.fm. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Have a good day.
You too. All right, folks, we've got to take a break. We'll be right back with a story of food stamps that's taking place in Pennsylvania. We'll be right back after this. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Some people say that bowling alley's got big legs. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. I am been IM'd by producer emeritus of the Majority Report, Josh Orton, that not only do we have creeping laws of kashrut in the city of New York, where you go into a restaurant and you order roast beef and Swiss, and they look at you like, you're crazy. According to producer emeritus of the Majority Report, Josh Orton, there's all sorts of Hasidic rabbinical courts in this country that do divorce and other sort of, I guess, disputes. It's all private contract enforced, basically, by the laws, what are known as halakhic laws. And apparently he did a law school paper on it, which is not available to anybody. But maybe we can get Josh to put it online. Maybe it is available. I don't know. Meanwhile, in Pennsylvania, there are two competing, obviously there are two competing narratives that are going on in this country right now. And one is reflected by Occupy Wall Street. It is now resonating. We mentioned earlier, we'll dig into this poll about the American people see the class conflict as the premier conflict in this country at this time. If you have time to, and we'll link on the blog at majority.fm, and maybe in the future shows, we'll just play the whole movie that Newt Gingrich's, or the Newt Gingrich supporting super PAC, essentially does 30 minutes on why Bain's vulture capitalism, headed by Mitt Romney, is antithetical to American values. And I appreciate the Republican Party, members of it, recognizing that it's not simply a question of what the law should be, but they're also that greed is not a value that we should embrace. We'll get into that more later. But the other competing narrative, which then Newt Gingrich will go on to spout when he's talking to the rubes in the Republican Party and his fellow Republican primary, will be that those people who receive any assistance from the government are necessarily trying to cheat us. Or as Rick Santorum would say, I don't want black people to take our money and get food stamps. I'm sorry, blah people. Forgive me. Blah people to take that money. And we see Republican legislators in the Senate, in the House, talking about people who are getting unemployment insurance should be drug tested as if they are criminals. And in Pennsylvania, the Republican governor is instituting, as of May 1st, asset tests for food stamps, not income tests, asset tests. Specifically, the Department of Public Works, as reported by the Philadelphia Inquirer, said that people under 60 with more than $2,000 in savings and other assets would no longer be eligible for food stamps. For people over 60, that limit would be $3,200, $3,250. Now, houses and retirement benefits would be exempt. But if a person owns a car, that would be exempt. But if they have a second car, like let's say I'm trying to, I've got a beat up old pickup truck. If it's worth more than $4,000, then I'm out of luck. And where does this impact people? Well, for instance, if you're elderly and you've saved up a little bit of money for your burial plot, or perhaps you have $3,500 you hope to give to your kids. Now, sorry, you cannot get any food assistance. Spend it. And when you're absolutely, totally destitute, then we'll throw you $200 a month so that you can eat. And it's not even $200, it's food stamps. It would say to people in poverty or people who are middle-class people who lost their jobs, you're not allowed to try and build any type of savings from which to seek new jobs, to use to maybe start a cottage business, whatever it is. We will not allow you to creep out of poverty, even though you may have virtually no or none, no income, and get that $200 worth of food stamps. And here's the worst part about this. Here's how you know this is simply about trying to create a stigma upon these people. Here's how you know it's simply a Republican trying to score points to show that they can be the most cruel and harsh to people who have suffered some form of misfortune. It doesn't save the state any money. It may save the federal government a little bit of money, but the state now has to create a whole new bureaucracy to determine what assets these people potentially have. They have to be trained to ascertain proof of assets. They have to get computers that will be reprogrammed. A recent survey of 26 states by the U.S. General Accounting Office showed that the vast majority of states polled believe asset testing would increase costs and caseworker workload. Increase costs. Never mind not save a dime. It's It's unbelievable. And remember, of course, that this food stamp program is a major economic stimulus. Every dollar of public funds spent on food stamps grows the GDP by $1.73. Because the food, it's all of those food stamps are spent. Nobody saves food stamps. You go and spend it on food. And you spend it at a market or a deli or whatever it is. And that money goes through the economy. It's unbelievable. It really is just despicable. All right, folks. Well, let me just tell you one. Let me just add this. Here's a story that came out of the Inquirer. Doris Gray, 72, divorced, college-educated, former graphic artist from Mount Airy with a heart condition, gets $200 a month in food stamps. Rent, insurance, and medical costs are more than her $1,079 monthly Social Security check. So she relies on $14,000 in savings to survive. Remember, most people don't have pensions. 60% of Americans rely on Social Security for over 50% of their income. Elderly. So she relies on dipping into this $14,000 worth of savings to survive. She estimates it will be depleted in 2 years. But before that's depleted, she will lose that $200 a month in food stamps. Congratulations. Congratulations to Pennsylvania. Let's take a break. We head into the better half of the program. There you can call me at 646-257-3920 or I am me at Majority FM. Folks, it's the beginning of the year. People who have fallen on similarly hard times make their decisions as to whether or not they can spend a certain amount of money on things. We've lost some members. If you can afford to become a member, we really need your support. Not only do you get the extra content, but you make sure that this show continues. And frankly, you make it easier for me to do it. Because eventually, hopefully, we'll get to the point where I don't have to be looking for another job.
To be fair, it's a combination of people going through hard times and me being here.
And, of course, Matt. And my occasional mocking of Chris Christie. So, I'm not going to jettison Matt. Yet. But don't make me jettison Matt. Have him go work at that Hallel Kosher, whatever it is, store across the street. Creeping kosher laws of kashrut. You can also support this program by buying your junk. If you buy junk through Amazon, buy it through our link. You just got to go to our Support the Show page. Click on the link, bookmark it, that's your Amazon. You will know no difference other than we get a tiny kickback each time you buy something. And, of course, support justcoffee.coop. You get great fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, organic if you wanted to. It's a great company. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get a 10% discount. We have our merch store is open. You can buy some Majority Report merch. Give it to your friends. Give us a rating on iTunes. If you, for some reason you had a problem with iTunes the past week, let us know. We think there was a hinky problem. We're trying to figure it out. All right. We'll see you in the better half, 646-257-3920. You can Skype us at Majority Live or you can IM me at Majority FM. We'll be back in just a moment.